Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every weekend on this fine radio station. The idea behind the show is pretty simple. No matter where your hometown is in this wonderful country of ours, whether that population is 4 million or 400, there are heroes around you, sometimes right next door. And so often we have no idea what some of these men and women have gone through for the sake of our freedom. I'm pretty sure if you spend the next hour with us, it'll be an eye-opening experience. Our guest today is not a veteran of World War II. So often, just about every week, we talk to World War II veterans. But today we're going to focus on what's been called the Forgotten War. It's a war that's impossible to forget. For Kenneth Eaton, who joins us today, there were many nights during the Korean War where he didn't know if he'd see his next birthday. I want to start you out even earlier than that. You know, with every World War II veteran, I ask about Pearl Harbor Day, and you were alive for that. In fact, your older brother was a paratrooper in World War II. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Is that day still pretty crystal clear in your memory?
Yeah, it is. I lived in a little town called Carlsbad at that time, and I can remember my mother and father saying that the war has been declared, the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor, and then within a couple of days, airplanes start. I never seen so many airplanes fly over the coast. I lived right on the coast. They were heading out to sea or heading to Hawaii to help out with what was going on there. Yes, I do remember it very vividly.
And you were just 13 years old at the time, but I understand you actually made some noise about wanting to sign up within not too long of that time.
Yes, that's very true. I wanted to join like my older brother did. He went into the paratroopers and was trained to jump.
And you would end up in the Army not too long after World War II. In fact, I guess, just about 3 years after the war was over, you were in the Army and headed to the Pacific yourself.
Yes, I joined 2 weeks before I turned 18. I joined, and I lived in Sanger then, and came to Fresno and enlisted. And they promised me, my dad was running a ranch there, a peach ranch. He needed myself and one of my brothers to work on a ranch and didn't want me to go into service. And wouldn't sign for me at 17, so when I was becoming 18 years old, I joined, and they promised me they'd put me on a train and get me to San Francisco that very day.
And so that was only about a year after World War II had ended. Why were you so determined to get into the service? Why was that so important to you?
My older brother had came home and explained a lot to me about it, and I'm an American. And I wanted to do what all young Americans wanted to do in that era, is join and defend our freedom.
Little did you know what you'd be in for, huh?
Absolutely. I never dreamed that there would be another war right after the Second World War so soon. My being in Japan when the war in Korea started got me over there. It started on June 15th, 1950, and I was there August 8th. Shortly after it started.
And you would be there for a long time. And we're going to try to fit in as much of Mr. Eaton's story as we can in this hour. But there's a lot more that I know we won't be able to cover. And if you want to read all about it, you can read his new book, Missing Dog Tags. You can find that at Barnes & Noble on Amazon.com. I'll put those links up on our website also at KMJNow.com. It's a book that I've got to warn you. Is pretty intense, and there will be some situations that you won't see coming that will pull at your heartstrings, that'll turn your stomach a little bit, and it's authentic. There's some language in there, too, that might take you aback at times, but it's true to the experience that Mr. Eaton had back there in Korea. And if there's anything that you want to touch on from the time that you got to Korea until you were captured, feel free to do so. If not, maybe we can start with that incident where you first became a prisoner of the enemy forces.
Well, my outfit had been, we had completely defeated the North Koreans, and I'd been all the way up to the Yalu River, or within about 50 miles of that, when the Chinese attacked, and we fought a defensive thing for several weeks till we got back to, I was south of the 30th parallel when the Chinese set a line there and continued to attack us. My platoon had been assigned to Rock Division, which was, regiment, which was fighting some Chinese cavalry in a valley called Hongsong, about 3 miles north of this village. My platoon of tanks was there to give them the available 90 millimeter guns to try to hold the Chinese when we were overrun by the Chinese. And after 3 days, and I was captured on the February 11th after my tank was, we'd been hit with a 3.5 bazooka, and it came inside the tank and blew up and killed three of the people within the tank, the driver and I. Well, the loader actually got out and died later, you know. Got out of the tank and concealed ourselves the best we could until the Chinese finally came, overran us there, and took us prisoner.
Well, and in reading your account of that incident in your book, Missing Dog Tags, the guy who was driving the tank was hit. You had to take over driving the tank. And then I vividly remember the way you described it there, because it got my attention. You basically said your head exploded. And I can't imagine what that feels like. Give us a sense of what that moment felt like for you. You're driving the tank, trying to find the road, trying to get in the right place while gunfire and artillery is going everywhere. And what happens?
Well, when you're a lot of automatic fire, the Chinese had this particular pass blocked where we couldn't get through without fighting our way through. The first tank had gone through. We had four tanks and radioed back. We were going to make individual runs at it, try to knock out their resistance so that we could get K Company. And we had over 500 American soldiers in this valley at the time trying to get out of this pass. First tank got through and radioed back and said, well, you can make it. It's all right. So the platoon leader and officer in charge of our platoon in the fourth tank said, okay, told the second tank, and we heard all the gunfire about a mile down the end of the valley, and he didn't radio back. So then the platoon leader, the lieutenant, told my tank commander for us to go, and we made a run for it. And that's when we got hit with a 3.5 bazooka and slid in behind the second tank, knocked out, and we blocked the pass entirely, two tanks. The lieutenant came in his tank about 15 or 20 minutes later, and I attempted to board his tank to get out of where I was at. I was lying behind a small slope. My tank commander had been there with me. I don't know where he went. I met him later on the death march. But I attempted to jump on the tank and was unable to do so while the lieutenant was getting. He'd got off of his tank and was pulling the dead and wounded out of the way so his driver wouldn't run over them as he came around on the sheltered side of my tank and the second tank to get his tank out of there. Well, he made it, but I never got on that tank.
No, you didn't, and you're left there to fend for yourself, not knowing what the rest of that day or any of those days would hold. And I'm curious what had to be going through your mind in that moment, because here you are all of, what, 21 years old, and you're out here in a war zone, you've just been knocked out of your tank. There's dead people all around you. How do you avoid just panicking in a situation like that?
Americans and human nature, I believe, is I've discussed this with a friend of mine just recently, and he asked me almost this same question. I think that my mind, as I recall, and that I do recall, is you're trying to figure out that your mind is racing, and you're trying to figure out the best way, or if you can get out of the situation you're in. And I don't think that under that situation, a soldier really has time to think about fear. You're trying to get out of where you're at and move on.
And move on you did. And man, I'm really blown away by your story after having read it. 32 months in captivity, the torture, the freezing cold, the strafing from your own planes that you'd have to endure. And you even mentioned a death march. But before you were actually taken prisoner, you had an idea, I think probably in your head, of what it might be like. You had heard stories, right, of how the Chinese and North Koreans had been treating their prisoners?
Well, I'd been on armored patrol, I think, three or four times prior to this. And each time we'd go on armored patrol, there'd be four tanks and a couple of flak wagons and with quad 40s and quad 50s. And we'd be well protected by our take care of ourselves, and we'd come into villages where the North Koreans, we'd run the North Koreans out, or the infantry had ran them out, and we'd come up on maybe 10, 15 American soldiers with their hands wired behind them, and they'd been shot in the face on the ditches on each side of the dirt road, or we'd find them within the village where they'd slaughtered the North Koreans had slaughtered they call them political prisoners. Anyone that wasn't with them was against them, and they'd kill them. Men, women, children, it made no difference. Yes, I was aware of what the possibility was when I got captured.
Well, and really it seems to me that just the idea of being captured was tantamount to death, that there was no reason to believe you could survive being a prisoner at their hands.
No, there wasn't, because of the knowledge I had and the experience I had prior to being captured. And so when I was first captured, I suspected that I probably would be shot within the hour. And the men around me immediately, when we were left in a circle with guards around us, in a stand of trees, we discussed that very lightly. Well, it looks like we're going to get what we've seen the other guys get. But as it turned out, the Chinese at that point in time had released some soldiers on the line a couple of months before, or maybe a month before. And so they kept encouraging us to not feel that way, because they had a lenient policy now, and they were going to try to indoctrinate us. That was about communism. And their interpreters constantly talked to us when they had the time to explain this to us, where little by little we started to relax. Well, some, until the death march started a couple of days later, and weeks later the death toll started from starvation and our wounded.
And you don't call it a death march for no reason. That very name implies what it was all about and what happened to many of the people on that march. And obviously when you started out, you had no idea how long they're going to march you or how far they're going to take you. You mentioned starvation. When did you get something to eat? And give us a sense of the things that began to appear to you as food that probably was never something you would imagine ingesting before.
Well, the very night of February the 11th, because of the continued activity of South Koreans trying to fight their way back in this valley, those of us that were captured from my platoon of tanks and some of the K Company infantry, they moved us about 300 yards off to the side up a small ravine, and there was an old building up there, and sometime during the night, they brought some South Korean soldiers in too, and there was maybe 60 of us at this time, and they brought out a tub of millet or sorghum cane seed. It's chicken feed boiling water, down to a mush almost. Their guards set it down amongst us and told us to eat. Well, we learned that the word savala means eat, but we didn't know what that meant then. And the South Koreans just start sticking their hands in it and eating it, and like it was the best thing they'd ever eaten. So I never tried it, but another American soldier walked over and said, hey, maybe we should try this out. These must be good, the way these guys are eating it. So he put his hand in and took a handful out and put it in his mouth and spit it out and said, my God, I can't eat that. And, of course, when he spit it out, a Chinese guard kicked him about 4 feet.
And at that time, you weren't ready to try any of that. But I'm sure over time, the more desperate things got, the more willing you were to eat things. By the end of this march, not to gross anyone out who's listening, but you were eating, by the end of your captivity anyway, you were eating kernels of corn that had actually been pulled from ox droppings?
Yes, well, dried. They use a lot of their... they're not as mechanized, the Chinese nor the North Koreans, although they did have Russian trucks to haul their supplies, but they also use oxen pulling carts with either ammo or mortar shells or their food on it. And, of course, they're fed at the various villages where they lay over from coming down from China or the northern part of Korea, and they're fed corn with millet and chopped up sorghum cane. When the first man we seen pick up a paddy when we was crossing a road where oxen had been going, and they're breaking it up, and you're looking up and you see someone putting something in his mouth, the curiosity works on you till you find out what it is. And it was undigested corn, kernels of corn, where they'd been fed field corn, and it passed through them whole, and any time a dried paddy could be found, if we were on a road, someone picked it up. You're very lucky if you found one.
And I think that gives you a sense at home at how desperate things were for Mr. Eaton and his fellow prisoners during the Korean War. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll get into some of his escape attempts. Eventually, we'll get to the day he was liberated. But boy, did he endure some serious stuff between the time he was captured and his liberation 32 months later. He's written about it in the book Missing Dog Tags. You can pick that up at Amazon.com.
You can find the front cover by checking out Ken's photo gallery on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And our focus on the Korean War continues when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.